Hi, folks. You are watching and listening to a very special edition of Open Bar. I'm Mike Morales here in sunny Southern California. That gentleman out there is.
My name is Rick Olivo, and I'm coming to you from sunny Austin.
Is it sunny today? Is it no ice? No ice storms? No none of that?
You know, Texas has this way to tell you we're getting ready to freeze you out. And then tomorrow, guess what? Beautiful weather. So it was a nice 72 right now, I think.
Oh, good. I'm glad. Folks, for those of you who are not aware of who Rico is, he is the gentleman in charge, the reason for we have Don Rico Tequila. And you'll see I've done a really hell of a great job on all of these expressions. First of all, Rick, I want to congratulate you because we're recording this just beginning of February, you know, somewhere like second week. And you folks are just now getting into Southern California. We just read about that not too long ago. 88 Spirits. Hari Dimon is I've known him for years. What a great guy and very, very interested in craft tequilas, craft mezcals. There's anything that's craft that's up his alley. And I'm so glad that pretty soon Christian will actually have all of Southern California to work. Right. So,
well, he's going to work the whole state.
Christian Olivo is Rick's son, who was nice enough to drop these off on my lawn and at my house. And unbeknownst to me, up until I started talking to him, he's a working actor.
He's been busy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's also doing a lot of your social media and filming. The guy's a filmmaker. You can catch him on Instagram. Go to Don Rico Tequila, catch him on Instagram. They've got a funny gag reel with your daughter. Yes. So I got to ask you, first of all, what's your background, Rick? Why did you start tequila? I mean, you and I are probably contemporaries anyway. So why not start sooner? Or why did you wait for this? And why come you didn't go into like vodka or something? You know, I don't know.
So I'll tell you this, you know, I drink beer and I drink wine. That's what I used to drink before. That was it. And so it's one of those things where I was never into the spirits. Oh, it looks like I got a little kind of cut out on me. Are you still there? Yeah.
Yeah, I'm still here. You look fine. You're okay.
A call came in, and it messed everything up. But anyway, yeah, so I was basically a beer drinker and an occasional wine drinker. That's it. And even the beers that I drank were boring. And so I was an attorney. I still am an attorney. And I was practicing law. And then I ended up becoming general counsel for a tequila brand, Dos Lunas Tequila. And that was back in 2008.
Oh, and we got to talk.
Yeah, so I got thrown into, you know, the world of 100% de agave tequila when it was starting to kind of blossom, right? I mean,
you got it
taken off and yeah.
What you got thrown into was the Dick Poe world, Richard Poe III.
Richard Poe. And he's a great guy, you know. But you know, he was involved in a lot of things, right? So right. I did a lot of work for the dealerships, the car dealerships and other things, but I was really intrigued by the tequila. And so that kind of piqued my interest. That started the process. And I ended up staying there about a year or so, and I went on to other legal work that I was doing. And so I always told my wife, you know, I think I can do this. I think there's something to this that I can be involved in. It's something I really like. I started to collect. I started to, you know, sip and taste different tequilas. And eventually it got to the point where I kept talking about it, but not doing anything about it. And as it turned out, my brother, his job moved him to Guadalajara. So, and that was about five years ago or so. And so I thought, you know what, now's the chance. Either I put up or shut up. It's time to go do something about this, right? And so I went, I started traveling about 3-4 times a year to Guadalajara, and we would just start visiting distilleries. You know, the first trip was, 6 or 7 different distilleries. And I went, you know, from, you know, Feliciano Vivanco and Asociados to Cascajuin. We went to Patron. And as you know, you can't just walk up to the Patron distillery. You got to be invited to go, right?
Right, so yeah.
We were fortunate that we got to do all of these big names and as well as great names, you know? And so that's how I started the first trip. And so from there, it's like, wow, do you go up or down from here? I mean, what's really happening? And so each trip we would visit different distilleries, try more tequilas, and probably, I don't know, I've tried 300-400 at least, right? And probably traveled to 36 at least different distilleries. And that's where the process, I decided on that first trip, okay, first let's learn, let's figure this out. And so I did trips to the CRT and we learned. They didn't have as formal a class, I don't think, at the time, but what we did was we'd spend the entire day with the different experts there, and we'd go down to the laboratory and you start talking about the soil, you touch it, you'd feel different types, you know, you talk about the plant, you talk all about the agriculture, you learn about the science behind it. And then we sat through the PowerPoint presentations that became their class on professionalism. And so, and then along those lines, I did several trips and I've probably taken that, the professionalism class probably 3 times. You know, my wife took the class, my daughter, my son took it. I have 2 other partners. They also took the class and I got the opportunity to show them first, you take the class, you learn the book side of it. And then now let me show you practically what this is really about. And so I got to show them all large distilleries, small distilleries, you know, autoclave, diffuser, you know, ordinal, you know, whichever it was, so that you could see the differences and say, okay, now let's taste these and let's find out why is one the type that you like? Why is one you don't like? And what can we do to make ours the way we envision, you know, what we're trying to do here? So, and that's how it kind of all got together. So it took me a little while to get started in it, but then I just jumped all in.
How many years did you do a lot of your due diligence, your research and all of that? How long did it take you?
So it probably 4 years. About 4 years before we actually had a final product. Now, keep in mind, we had gone through 3 different distilleries. We had negotiated with a number of them. So the first one, it just for whatever reasons, it didn't work out. So we went to the second one. We had a product made. We had a Blanco and a Repa only. And then we had some technical issues with them and their NOM. And so we went and found another one. And then when we found the next one, that's when we spent the time saying, okay, this is what I'm trying to do. This is the effect I'm trying to do. It's kind of a little bit of a joke, but I love to cook. My daughter gives me a hard time because I don't taste the food as I cook it. Because in my mind, well, I know what I put in it. I know what those things taste like. And that's kind of what it was with the tequila when I started. And it's like, no, we've got to taste this now. we've got to go in there and say, okay, this is what we like. This is what we don't like. You know, and after aging it and doing the barreling, you know, and pulling out samples here and there, to say, okay, this is what we're trying to go for, or, you know, let's do 2 side-by-side barrels of different product. Which one do we like better, you know, and then kind of focus on that. And that was the accident behind the Añejo, is that we were doing 2 different things.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah. Your Añejo is actually double barreled, right?
It's double barreled, yeah. And so what happened was they needed the barrels that the Añejo was in. So all they had available was that French oak Cabernet. That red wine. And so let's put it there for now, just to kind of put it somewhere. Next thing you know, it came out the way it did. And we thought, and my thing, I'm not, you know, a bourbon guy. I'm not, you know, and I can detect, you know, those aromas, the taste and all that. And I thought, I don't know if this is going to really work. And we went through the process. And then when we're finally done, it's okay, now we got to dilute it, right? We got to cut it down because it's 55%. We got to go to 40. How's that going to change the flavor? And so we finally did some tests, you know, and I said, you know, let's go with it. There were some others that we'd been working on. There was an extra, an Añejo that we had that was in a new white oak barrels, and that's it. And they were very light. It was a very, very light Añejo. I loved it, but it wasn't, you know, it didn't quite fit what I was trying to do with, you know, from one expression to the next. To the next, that they
flowed. There wasn't that progression you were looking for.
Exactly. And so as much as I liked it, I was like, yeah, it doesn't work with this concept that I have in mind. And so who knows, maybe down the road, we might have another expression. I doubt it, but there's always, you know, you never say no, right?
Well, you know, what's driving the market right now is all the extra añejos, the ultra, segment of the market that's, you know, that's dry, you know, it's got the nice bottle, it's got the nice package, it's been aged, you know, over 5 years. And, you know, it's interesting you mentioned Dos Lunas, because for anybody who's had tequila of Dos Lunas or from that distillery, Tequilas El Señor, one of the greatest tequilas that ever came out of there was, they had a 7 year, they had a 5 year, which I really enjoyed. I think it was,
Herencia Histórico.
Herencia Histórico. Yeah. It was 5 years, 7 years. And then it went, I don't know, 12 or something. And it used to come, the bottle's beautiful. For those of you who are collectors, you probably have one in your, you do. It came with a real glass as well in that box. And that's the one at Ensa Historical.
And this is the 15 year.
That's the 15 year. Yeah. Now, what we had heard at that time was that, you know, people, some of the old dogs who had started the business and started importing what we call now boutique tequilas, were saying, you know, if you age it anything over 5 years, the tequila starts to taste like anything but tequila. Right. And, you know, Tequilas El Señor was one of those that 5 year was one of my favorites, because it was just for me, the right amount of creaminess. It was like a root beer creaminess or cream soda, and still, you know, enough of the agave that was there.
Right.
7 years after that, it did start to taste like something else.
It's like a fine cognac, right? I mean, it becomes another drink, right?
Well, you know, when you're dealing with a distillery that grow their own, you know, in those days they weren't in a deficiency as we are now, you know, and a shortage like we are now. And so the plant stayed in the ground a lot longer, things like that. Right. So the character was still there. Now I wonder, did you ever go to that distillery and say, you know, because Dos Lunas was really cutting edge with some of the stuff they were doing, especially that super extra añejo they had in the sherry barrels.
Yeah. So I didn't make it early on to their distillery, but I did later years, right? So more recently. And so that 10 year that Dos Lunas had was basically this 15 year, or was that 5 year or the 7 year that you had seen.
Right.
So what they did was they had quite a bit of barrels that they had just put away. And, you know, so Richard Poe, when he came in and he saw, he goes, well, I'll take some of those and I'm going to do this. So he had that really nice crystal Baccarat that was made. And it's gorgeous. I mean, but they were selling that for $2,500, right? You had that ebony wood box, everything about it. One thing about Richard is he didn't hold back. You know, he went all in and he did it. You know, he spent the money to make it real nice.
Yeah.
So what they did was Herencia Histórico, under the brand for Tequilas El Señor, they came up with that 5 year, right? And then he did the 10 year. I think they did the 7 also. And then he did the 10, Dos Lunas did the 10 year. And then for the 15 year, they decided to do it as an anniversary. And I'm not sure exactly which anniversary it was, but it was 1997, I think, when it came out. And so what they did was they just had all these barrels and they would just release, you know, each time a few of them, and they just aged the rest of them.
Right.
And so this one here, this 15 year here, I mean, you can see them in that dark color. That's
there.
That sherry barrel really, you know, does a lot. It's a very unique color.
Yes.
It's typical of like Tears of Llorona. That's a sherry, but this is in part of where my idea was on our extra añejo that we have in barrels now. And it's a sherry barrel.
Now I heard I was watching another interview you did, and my understanding is the sherry idea, or Jerez, as we call it in Spanish, is part of your heritage from Spain, correct?
Right. Yeah. So, you know, my mother's born and raised in Spain, and we lived there growing up, all of my elementary school years living in Spain.
Oh,
and
wow.
So we lived in Sevilla. We lived also outside of Madrid and outside Madrid there in a little town called Alcalá de Henares, but also outside of Sevilla. And that home that we had there was relatively close to Jerez de la Frontera, which is the town, which is the region that is the capital of the region for the production of Jerez. And so, you know, it, because it's all Andalusia, which is the province, or it's kind of like a state here, right? A small one, albeit, but there's a lot in common with the people from that whole region. And so for me, it was bringing in some of my heritage into the tequila as well, which others have done already, right? But it for me, it was a little bit more of me in the product.
Right. It was a much more personal reason than just looking for something, a different element.
Exactly. Know? Right.
How did you pick this distillery? For those of you who have never seen this right now, it is Texas has it all over at this point. But California will shortly. It's Nome 1608, which is Los Valores, is the name of the distillery. There's like four tequilas that come out of there. I checked the Nome list. There's like not even a handful. How did you choose? How did you run across that one? And why did you go with it?
So like I said, we this is our third distillery and the one that we finally launched with, right? The first one, like I said, for whatever reason, it just didn't work out because they were not going to be able to produce for us in the future going down. We wanted to grow and they felt they would not be able to grow with us in the long term.
Okay.
We found another small distillery that was in El Arenal. Then we found another small distillery that was in Amatitan, and they were doing a lot of production for other NOMs. But they were in the process of having their NOM registered and doing all that process, and there were a lot of delays. And we had already started production because we knew by the time it was done, we were going to have a product, right? Mm-hmm. And they'd have the NOM all situated. But, you know, with the delays, CRT, whatever they were, it just didn't happen. And so we were working with an individual and they're in Mexico that is in the business. And he says, you know, I'm looking around and he found some, but they were, you know, for instance, it was all autoclave and only autoclave. And I thought, well, that's not going to work. He goes, you're really going to like the product though. And I'm like, I don't care. I want a traditional, and there's some great autoclaves. Don't get me wrong. You know,
oh, yeah.
But I wanted a traditional tequila. I didn't want to take shortcuts. I wanted to put the time in to do this, what I felt was the right way, the traditional way, to give it honor, right? Mm-hmm. And so we just kind of kept looking, and just purely by accident, he came across Los Valores. And the story behind Los Valores, Ricardo Aguilar, he has Don Rich. And so you may have heard of Don Rich, and that was being produced at a different distillery. And this was years ago, many years ago. And for whatever reason, they decided not to continue the production there. And so he decided, well, I'm going to build my own distillery so that I can produce my own tequila. That was probably 10 years ago. And in that time, he's not produced. So he had a lot of product, but most of which was being sold in Mexico, but he didn't produce for himself because he was starting to produce for everybody else.
Right.
And he just found that niche where he was doing a lot of production for other NOMs, right? And so it took a while. He had two tequilas that were registered through the CRT with his NOM, but then they never actually produced them. He has now since moved over Don Rich to it. Mm-hmm. And so he's planning on now producing that. They haven't launched it, the new version yet. And he has a couple others. For instance, I believe
Otomi is one that I've just was just contacted by Otomi.
Right. Otomi. So what they're going to be doing is they're the ones. I think that they're the people out of Chicago, maybe.
I'm not sure where they're. I just found out about them. They just reached out to us, and it wasn't until I actually checked the Nome list right now before we came on. I said, I want to make sure I get that Nome right. And I thought, oh, there's that name that they just sent me the email like 2 days ago. So I, you know, and they're like the fourth one on that list, and that's it. That's all that's coming out of that distillery.
Right. So yeah. So he's looking at his idea was that he was going to produce three of his own brands and three outside brands, and that's it.
Oh, perfect.
But they're producing right now about 3,000 liters a day with one shift. So it's a big production. And I'll tell you, they've got two autoclave ovens there. They've got two large hornos brick ovens. They have a column still. He just put in a 6,000 liter stainless pot with copper coils. So everything that he has is basically stainless pots with copper coils. He has a Thaona that's never been used. We've sampled some things with it. So we're planning on some, I think, exciting products, you know, coming down.
Yeah.
For instance, you know, with that extra añejo is going to be something a little bit different, but we're also going to be working on a high proof Thaona version of Don Rico.
Oh my God.
And so we're working on trying to secure a full copper pot, which is, as you know, glass is at a shortage, copper's at a shortage, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, yeah. I was going to ask you, how did the pandemic? Yeah. Well, first of all, let me back up a little bit. The stories that I've heard from other people who have brought brands to market prior to the pandemic is, you know, the rule is it takes about anywhere from 2 to 4 years because you have a lot of paperwork on both sides of the border. And I think the quickest I've ever heard was also from a former lawyer, female lawyer, who said it took her 24 months, I think, maybe less than that, for the paperwork on both sides of the border from conception to on the shelves. And that's the fastest I've ever heard. But then again, she's a lawyer, but I know that the paperwork is in English and Spanish. I mean, I asked you about the research. How long did it take you just in paperwork, just in getting the ball rolling and, you know, the trademarks and the laws, of course, on both sides of the border are completely different.
So I'm going to shock you then. Now, mind you, I did a lot of the work ahead of time, right, in terms of finding what I wanted and then trying to narrow down for a profile, right?
Right.
But I organized the company in 2020, July 30th, 2020, right? I filed at the same time the trademarks in Mexico and in the U.S. The trademarks in Mexico, I had them by December 7th.
Wow.
And technically from September to December 7th, because when I started the process, I was working with Mexican counsel. And so they actually submitted it at the beginning of September by December 7th. And of course, everybody told me, Don Rico, you're not going to get it, right? We got it. And so it was a big surprise because we went through, I do a lot of trademark work myself in the US. I did a lot of those searches in advance, for all, you know, we went through 20 different names, right? And, so we landed on Don Rico. And I knew that I could probably get it in the U.S. And so I thought, why not? Let's try in Mexico. So they did it. They got it. It happened fast. In the U.S., that Don Rico, they declined it. They denied it. And then I fought them on it. So I appealed it. I challenged it. And then I won. And so I got
that. I guess it pays to be your own lawyer, huh?
Right. So we got the approval maybe in the mid-fall. You know, maybe around that time is when we got it. And so, but we had already at that point now started the whole process, right? We had already started the preparation of the, you know, getting the agave, doing the cooking, doing the, you know, the fermentation, the distillation, everything. We had already started that process in advance. And so then after we get the paperwork, we start the process. Okay, now we got to get the bottles. We had order for bottles ready to go. And then I get a notification because now we go into the new year last year and they tell me, we don't have any bottles for you. Pandemic. So I had to start all over again, even though I'd been ordering those bottles for 6 months. I've been trying to get an order in. And so finally in January, they said, well, we don't have any bottles for you. And then in February, they said, here's the new price. They upped the prices. Then they said, okay, well, maybe we can get something for you in March. I said, okay, let's do it. And then March came around. It's like, we don't have any bottles for you. It's like, are you kidding me? So we went to Saverglass and talked. I told him my dilemma. I've been waiting, you know, months, and this happened with the other company. And so he says, well, I think I can help you out. He goes, we're not doing any new production for new companies. And I said, but I've got tequila ready to go. And he goes, it doesn't matter. We just don't have the production time available.
Right.
So he calls back and says, he goes, you know what? We've got somebody that canceled an order and it was what we were looking for. I said, I'll take it. and then it didn't happen. That somebody else sold it to someone else. And he says, oh, I found you some more. So now we're going up to June. We're expecting to have it by May. So now we're up to June, and we got our bottles finally. They get delivered. And so we start that whole process. In the meantime, we're getting all the paperwork done for the approvals of the labels with the CRT. We have to now transfer, of course, you know, your trademark has to be affiliated through the CRT with your NOM. Right. So you have to go through that whole process. And we were doing that without having bottles, even though we had tequila. We had ordered the lids because we had those custom made out of China. They were running late. And so we rushed to get them in. We finally got them in by May, but then now we didn't even have the bottles, even though we rushed to pay to get those caps. So we had all these problems. We had our launch party July 24th, which is National Tequila Day.
Right.
And, but we had already planned it. People were coming from out of town. A lot of things were going on. We weren't going to cancel it. Right. So we had the launch party, but we didn't have tequila. So I had to drive to Mexico.
Oh my God.
To personally go pick it up. And then bring it. So what happened was we shipped cases to the border. I went to the border. I crossed over in Laredo to Nuevo Laredo. I went through the process to bring it in. We only had 9 cases. That was it. And we used that for our launch party so that we had our tequila at our own launch party, right? And then the pallet didn't come in until August. So to give you an idea, from the time that I filed the paperwork, July 30th,
right,
to the following August, the following year, we had product in the U.S.
Wow.
It was
what? Even with all the delays and stuff.
That, all those problems. So it was 14 months is what it took us to.
Wow. Wow.
So it, but remember, I had done all of the early work for the production side, even though we didn't have an ultimate product, we started the process. And so when it was done, we were ready to go ahead and present to the CRT. Here's our samples. Here's our labels. We did the same thing while they were doing it on the Mexican side, I was doing it with TTB on the US side. But yes, the fact that I have the legal background and I had done these things before, that really made the difference. Because if, you know, I say it still today, I don't know what I don't know. And you know, every day I'm learning something new. And even though I've been in this business a long time, I'm learning stuff every day.
So what surprises you about the business now? I mean, you know, when you started the Dos Lunas thing, of course, sadly, that brand is no longer available. And so from the time that you were involved then to now, what sort of surprises and things what sort of changes have you seen that you've noticed have been really just dramatic for you?
So I always thought that back then, it's kind of when the premium market started to take off, right? Patron was already big. Everybody was buying it. You know, bottle service was a thing. And so I believed at that time that the tequila business was about being cool. So if you were an owner, you were owning it because you were cool. If you were drinking it in a club, people saw you drinking and say, wow, this guy's got to have money because that's a premium product. So they're cool.
Right.
And I didn't necessarily see myself as necessarily being that cool guy. I just liked a good quality product. So that's what I wanted to do, was say, how can I change it? And I think we went from a stage of being really cool, celebrities jumping in, because a lot of things happened first with Patron. That's really, it was a celebrity band, but even
yes. Cabo
that didn't have a celebrity status, even though it was. And then, of course, the way he sold that brand, you know, throwing out a number. Okay, we'll pay it.
Yeah.
Wow. You know, and so it started building. So then it became about, this is a great way to make a profit, you know, just to make money. And so I saw those kinds of swings. Right. And so I think we're starting to see more today. Brands kind of like mine, where people are really concerned about the product. If you look at, you know, what Guillermo's done with Fortaleza, you know, he's always been about the heritage of tequila, right? And the agave. And so I think he's kind of started that. And he's brought a lot of people along with him to kind of say, yeah, you know, we need to do some of those things. You know, Siete Leguas, you know, still is a big part of that, right?
Yeah.
And that's where Patron started, right?
Yeah, you know, right. Exactly.
Yeah, that you know, Patron didn't just appear all of a sudden, was a great, you know, brand. It had been there since the Legos had been producing that. It was their brand. Yep. And they sold it, you know. So, you know, that's part of it, I think. And for me, learning the history of brands, learning the history of the product, of where it's come, where it's going, I think there's a place in the market for all of those. You know, the big brands, they're always going to be there, right? They've got a price point. They've got the marketing. They've got the numbers. People are always going to love those products, right? Whether you like them or not, as the masses are going to love them. And right. That's great, right? Because they brought people into the industry. The celebrities are always going to have a place in the industry because, again, they're bringing them in for a different reason. So there's not a reason for us to talk them down. It's applaud them because it makes it possible for the smaller brands to say, now taste this and taste that one. And you see the difference. And let's kind of move them over to our side, you know, to something that's a little bit better.
Yeah, since 2000, 2001, since the industry was starting to up level its image from a shooter to a sipper, you know, with the invention of the Riedel glass and then everything else and the Mexican Tequila Academy and all that. Everybody says it's been an uphill battle, but it's been I've been with Tequila Aficionado 23 years. And I've seen, you know, a lot of, like you, a lot of the ups and downs. And that's when you mentioned Dos Lunas, it's a very special story, you know, that part of the chapter, I tell people that I feel a lot like the tequila Forrest Gump. Like I've been surrounded by history, but you don't know, you're shaking hands with JFK or, you know, whatever. You're just, right. You just happen to be there, you know, and not all the stories are pretty, you know, especially in the early days of boutique tequilas and what they call craft now. We used to call boutique then, you know, and those are the old Chinacos and the old Tesoros, and you know, before Beam invested heavily into them, and similarly to what Ocho is now, and Guillermo Sauza, we were fortunate to take our first. We did a tour before tours were a big thing. Somebody had actually arranged it over through a tequila forum. This was prior to Facebook. You know, as I tell people, we kind of grew up with the internet. And so we started with like email lists, you know, where people would join like a Yahoo email list, and we'd all, and everybody on that thread would get the same email together, you know, and that's where I met a lot of the, what I consider heroes, you know, that other people may consider dinosaurs in the industry, but they were heroes then. And then, you know, you kind of graduate with whatever platform. And then we did a tequila forum, and somebody said, let's organize a tour. And there were like 35 of us. And it was really the biggest blind date I've ever been on, because none of us knew each other personally, but we all met. We all signed up and said, let's do it. And it was really a life changer. And for me, it was after I had already done tequila shows in New Mexico.
Right.
We had done it like for 4 years in Albuquerque before there were any tequila shows, not like there are now.
There's a lot of people in the business, on the fringes of the business,
right,
that are knowledgeable, right? And so they've, you know, jumped on board to help promote, you know, the better quality stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And so one of our stops at that tour was Guillermo Erickson Sauza. And it was it was truly a living museum. And right. We were in that cava, and I remember telling everybody, and I'm sure Guillermo would remember I haven't seen him in a few years, but you know, we were in that cave before there were lights and a bar. That was just a cave. It was dark and cold.
Right.
And all it was, you know, if you didn't have a flashlight, you couldn't see anything in front of you. So you
couldn't have flashlights on your phones back then.
Yeah. Well, no, we didn't even, some of us hadn't even converted yet to cell phones, you know, except for early adopters. I was still using a Canon Elf, you know, it was a digital, but no, actually I was using film. I was using a film camera. And so, you know, you can't like turn on a flash and do any of that stuff. So I remember tasting the first batch number one of, and all we couldn't see it. All we could do was smell it and taste it in a shot glass. And I knew then it was special. And it's been special ever since. And I just knew. And then talking to him and interviewing him on the bus and getting to know him, and his mother at that time was still alive, Sylvia. She was a spitfire, just a very elegant woman, and who was still angry at Domecq.
At her dad, maybe, for selling it off.
Her dad, yeah, sold it. Ever since Domecq had it, they ruined the brand. And she was still angry. She had these beautiful, piercing blue eyes, and she was still ticked off. You know, that's what I remember the most, is she still had that passion, you know, that fire in her belly about what happened. And anybody who's interested in the Before Talesa story, you can do your research on that. There's a wonderful NPR interview with Guillermo Sauza where he tells the story of finding out, you know, he was being groomed as a child to take over that company, and then it was sold out from under him. And he still had that's a trauma for him. You still could hear it in his voice. There was still a crack in his voice when he tells that story over and over again. And you feel for that, because you're right. It's the brands and the family with pedigree. So I understand that you're cut from that cloth.
Right.
Other than also being a judge.
I tell you, see, my thing has always been, you know, the brands that I liked, you know, from, even like, you know, Sid de Leguas or Tesoro de Don Felipe, you know, obviously Fortaleza, Tequila Ocho, you know, I the things about those products that I liked always went back to the tradition of tequila production. And so even if you don't know anything about it, if you're making those comparisons and you're just tasting, there is a difference. You don't have to be an expert to notice the difference. And so I wanted to be that. I wanted to be the tradition of tequila. But, you know, part of what you asked earlier about what's changed, right? And the fact that the prices, because of the shortages, you know, glass shortage, agave shortage, you know, the demand, the everyone that's involved, you know, the more companies, the competitive nature of it, that means that the prices have skyrocketed. You know, when I was with Dos Lunas, it was $3 per kilo for the agave, right? A mature agave. And today you're paying for mixed batches. Well, it was 28 when we started this process. I think it's 33 or something now per kilo. And you've got mixed agave in there. And so it's changed, right? And I wanted as best as possible to try and say, look, we've got a product that the aficionados appreciate and can respect, but that it's still accessible to the masses, to everybody else. I know I'm not going to compete with the celebrity brands. I'm not going to compete with those big brands. I just want to find my little spot in there that basically says, you know what? Everybody can enjoy this. You don't have to have a lot of money. You don't have to necessarily be the cool kids, right? You just have to appreciate quality. And you don't have to pay too much for it. So that's kind of where this whole thing came along. And it's kind of been my vision, my dream. And I'm thrilled because with Los Valores, they're amazing. They're willing to work with me. They're allowing me to be involved in the process from the beginning to the end. You know, it's not where you go to a distillery. Look, I want to own a brand. I go to a distillery and they said, well, here are the three options we have. Which one do you like? Okay, that's it. Here's your price. We're done. We got to develop it. We got to build something from scratch. We built, or we're building. Now, we haven't built it yet, but we're doing that with the name, right? It's a whole new brand starting from the very beginning. And I just felt it necessary that we weren't something else or somebody else's idea, that we had our own image, our own personality kind of going forward, and we'll work on it. You know, we're going to improve upon it and we're going to do better as we go. You know,
what I really enjoy is, I do some consulting on the side. I have for several years. And one of the brands that I consult with, I always ask the question of the brand owner. I said, why did you choose tequila? You know, why didn't you go into vodka or try something else? You know, because I feel that, especially as tough as this industry is, the liquor business, I think the tequila industry is especially challenging because because of the source material, the prime material that right. that they start with. It's not a grain. It's not, you know, it can't be
a grape. You know, you grow the vine again, right?
Yeah. Right. It can be sustainable, but there's a long, it's a long game. Okay. Right. And I asked him, and he said, you know what he said to me? He said, well, you know, obviously he loves the quality of what he has on the market right now. But he said, honestly, I wanted a business that my family, my kids would stay together and continue on. Because he told me the story about a friend of his, not one of his investors, but a friend of his that started a construction company so that his kids could all stay together, so that the family would stay together. Right. And what I love about Don Rico, if you haven't seen their Instagram account, everybody's involved. You are the missus. I think her name is Sharon. Sharon,
that's
is
right. Yes. Wife. She's the driving force behind everything.
Driving force. It was, yeah. So it's her fault. Okay. and then there's Tiana and Christian, who are the siblings, your right. son and daughter. So, well, now here's the other thing that I've discovered. You have, there are nieces and nephews who are also involved in the tequila industry with other brands, correct?
Yes. Yeah. So as I mentioned, my brother moved to Guadalajara. And so, and then of course they're there during COVID. And so their kids, while in college and after college, you know, obviously working remote, were able to do so from Guadalajara. And so they got involved, you know, of course they, you know, took advantage of the region and visited a lot of different places. My brother and his wife were able to do that quite a bit. And so what they ended up doing was they started a distribution company in Texas. And so their son is basically running that. Day to day. And so he's now in Houston. He has a couple of brands. He has Amor Indio and Casa Verde, which both come out of Casa Marengo distillery. I think it's 1560 Nam. And then they also have a mezcal that they also represent. So they represent those three brands. And then of course, my niece, having been quite a bit, she's La Tequilana, right?
So right. We interviewed her for Open Bar, as a matter of fact. We did at the time. She was a member of a group of young ladies, and
yeah, the Tequi ladies, right?
Yeah, the Tequi ladies, and I had a chance to have a good conversation with her. She was based in D.C. She was right. And then recently got married. So, you know,
She went to American University, and that's where, you know, Billy, Guillermo's son had gone to school. And I think they kind of crossed. He may have been a senior when she was a freshman. And so they didn't get to know each other, but they got to know each other later. And so that was kind of a connection. So the family's kind of involved, you know, even, and I'll tell you beyond that, we have two partners that have joined us as well. Ken Long and Bassam Ahmed, we all went to the same high school together in Egypt. So this goes, our relationship goes back 40 years. Is it 40 years, man? Something like that. Almost 40 years.
So you're pretty well traveled. Was your family, right. was your father like an ambassador or something? Or, I mean, you lived in Spain and then you went to high school in Egypt, and that's really you're well traveled there. So you got a lot of stamps on your passport.
On the passport. Right. Yeah. I still have a stack of all the expired ones. My dad was a diplomat. And so first he was in the Air Force, and he did that for 25 years, and he retired, and then he joined the State Department and then did that for an additional 20 years. So, you know, I started out young. You know, I was 9 months old. We went to the Philippines, lived there for 2 years, traveled here in the U.S. And then my dad ended up going to Vietnam. And so the family went to Spain because my mother was from Spain. And so we went with her family to stay there. And then he got stationed in Spain. So we ended up staying for almost 8 years. The house that I grew up in, we still have it there. And that's in Sevilla. And of course, we moved back to the States for a little while. And then my dad joined the State Department. And then that's when I went to high school in Egypt. He moved on to Belgium and then to Ecuador. He was in Mexico for a while in Tijuana. He was in Ecuador twice, actually. He was in Guinea in West Africa and Italy. So we got to do a lot of the traveling and got to visit a lot of places, you know, while in high school, traveling throughout Europe for sports competitions or Model United Nations. So I got a lot of exposure to a lot of cultures, a lot of places, just in general, foods, So I've always been intrigued by what each place has to offer. So it stands to reason that, you know, tequila is unique to Mexico, that it's something that, having been there, that I'm in a position where I can share it. And so that's what we're doing, is we're getting to share part of these experiences.
Do you feel that your ability to cook? Wow, that was really interesting. That's my ring light just had an accident. Do you feel that your ability to cook and played a role in picking the flavor profiles that you did? Because folks, if you have not seen our review of Don Rico, Bryce Taylor, the Austin connoisseur, who is also one of our TJs at Tequila Aficionado, he and I really had a great time dissecting these. And really, each of these kind of has a different, you know, it's almost as if there is a natural progression, but there's also kind of a separate, so that everybody can pick a favorite, you know.
Right.
You know, I know that you were looking for a natural progression, but I think what happened was you actually, especially with the Añejo, what happened, that was like a completely different, you know, it doesn't go the natural progression. It's like a leapfrog, you know.
it changes the whole idea of what we had to go from one to the next. Clearly the Blanco is the base for all of it. So we started with that same Blanco for all of them. And it wasn't, okay, we produced a batch and then started it. And then we produced a different batch to go with the Repo, and then a different batch to go with the Añejo. They all came from the same batch. So the production from the very first one. So
That's good. So
that started in the same place. That Añejo did take a turn, right? It was a little bit different because the barrels were a little bit different in that, you know, in Mexico, they don't make the distinction between whiskey and bourbon, right? But there is a distinction between
them. There is, yes.
And so for them, it's, okay, whiskey barrel for the Repo and bourbon barrel for the Añejo. It's in essence, it's kind of a whiskey bourbon, right? There's a blend of barrels and stuff, but there's a predominance. And then, of course, the issue was, you know, the toasting of the barrel in the inside. We want to make sure I didn't overdo it. I'm not a mezcal drinker. I'm not into the smoky drinks at all. And so I didn't want them to toast it too much. So we had to make sure that it was a very light to medium toast at the most. It was the same thing with the wine barrels. But for that, we had traditional whiskey barrels and traditional bourbon barrels, right? And it was those bourbon ones that moved into the wine barrels. And so we had to be very cautious on how the toasting, for instance, and then the transfer of them, to make sure that it was very specific, right, what we were doing.
Mm-hmm.
That wine barrel really did something. When it first went in there, and the first time we did a sampling, it was dark, like really dark, because that wine just took a hold of it right away. And over time, it started to dissipate a little bit. And so it changed it. And so it was a very nice surprise. It was unexpected. And so what we decided to do is, with the Repo, is we're still going to have that same base. So we're producing extra Blanco and then using for the Repo, and then taking the Repo that we've done and then putting that in the wine barrel, specifically going to make sure that we keep that same line, that family line.
It was interesting because Bryce and I had experience with a brand that actually exclusively ages their tequila in wine barrels. And so we had a base, you know, we had an Añejo in a wine barrel. We had had even an extra Añejo in a wine barrel. And so when we did your review, it was like, wow, that was an eye opener, because I really, frankly, I enjoy the dryness that you get, you know, the tannins that you get that a wine barrel will impart into tequila, especially if the tequila starts very well. As you said, the Blanco is the base of everything. If you don't like that Blanco, then the rest of the line is just, you can mask and hide everything and fix a lot of mistakes with a barrel. But, you know, in order to do it right, especially I think in a wine barrel, that Blanco has got to have enough character to stand up to the tannins in the barrel of a wine, of the one you use for wine. And we were really pleasantly surprised. I thought, oh man, this is, because we love that other brand that's just all aged in wine barrels. Is that, nah, this is a winner. And to come find out it was you know, kind of a fortuitous thing right. that happened for you, you know?
Well, you know, it's still a tequila, right?
So oh, yeah, yeah.
As an añejo, you still want it to be a tequila and you still want it to taste the agave, and that's hard to do. And that's my concern with this extra añejo that we're doing now is I still want, even as an extra añejo, my original thought was 4 years. And we're about 2 years in right now. Then I started playing with the idea of hitting to 5 years. But talking to the guys there, the master distillers there, they said, you know, we're worried that there may be just a hint of that vinegar or something, a little change in the flavor, something's going to happen. And so I'm kind of torn in between right now, the 3 and the 4 years, somewhere in there, so that we can still get agave and we can still get the true essence of a tequila, but with that, you know, that hint of the sherry, or at least the character of the sherry that's going to, you know, change it, give it more of a, like a velvetiness in your mouth kind of right. thing. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that's where your taste buds are going to come in, and, you know, you got to make the trip down there and get the samples and, you know, and then you tell us, because whatever you decide, that's what it's going to be. Are you going to change the bottle? Are you going to give it a nice little package? Like,
yeah. You know, I think we need to for the extra. Now, mind you, we only have one barrel at the 22 months right now. We have about 12 barrels. We have about 3,000 liters that are about just under a year. So we're starting in this process, right, to try and plan for the future. But that first barrel, it's, you know, there's only going to be, what, 300, 350 bottles maybe out of it, and yeah. that's it. And so that's going to be kind of our test market. I think it deserves its own presentation. I don't know that I want to go with the big box and all the fancy stuff that goes around it, but I think the bottle needs to stand out on its own because it's a product that's a little bit different. Mm-hmm. And again, it is the same Blanco, but it's not from the Repo or from the Añejo. It's entirely its own, you know, because it's the wine. Yeah. So that is something that I think the bottle being a little different, the presentation being a little bit different, will show that what's inside is just a little bit different than the others. You know, when we do the high proof, you know, the Taona version, mm-hmm. that one's probably going to be the same bottle, but maybe a different color label, but the same label, basically the same look, right. but only to distinguish it as being just the production's a little bit different, but it's the same mature agave. It's the same process with the, you know, the fermentation, which is so important because we use all natural agave yeast. So it comes right from the agave itself.
I checked, I think after Bryce and I did the review, I had not had any information. And at the time I probably didn't have enough time to actually go back into the website. So after we did the review, I checked the distillery, and I was really intrigued that they have open air fermentation, but it's a below ground
yes.
stainless steel. And the only time I've ever seen below ground, when I say below ground, in other words, the fermentation tanks are I don't know if they use gravity to pour the juice down to the bottom of what is their fermentation tanks. These are stainless steel lined, if I'm not mistaken.
Right.
But the last time I saw something like that was in a Sotol distillery, and they call them Vinatas. And one of the Sotoleros that I'm very familiar with, a good friend of mine, he has below ground fermentation tanks, which are more concrete. You know, they look like almost like a pool, that kind of smooth concrete that they, and it's like, I was very intrigued because in the tequila distillery, I've never seen that. Yeah. Usually the tanks are above ground, you know, and they're stainless right. steel or they're wood, you know.
These are nine tanks, right? They're nine tanks. And of course they've got I don't want to call it a ladder system, but there's like a bridge system over the top of them. There's two separate roller mills that they have. One has four passes. The other one is three passes depending on which ones they're using at the time. They feed into underneath, you know, you have that little, I'll call it a drainage system
right.
where it collects, where they add the water and it collects it. It's the same system that feeds in from the Taona that's right next to it. So they both go into the same system And then they go ahead and then they fill in the tanks from there. So there is a, I will call it a plumbing system that goes to all separate 9 tanks.
Wow.
And so, yeah, so you can walk over the top so you can test it and check it out, you know, and then you can reach down. But yeah, it's all basically at ground level. And so that drainage goes right into it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very unique. I thought for sure it's like, wow, this is, you hear about stuff like that with some of the mezcalerias in the Palenques, where they're up on a hillside and they have to use the gravity to naturally, drain either the pot still or, right. Drain into the barrel so that it makes the fermentation. And I looked at that. It's like, wow, that's no wonder it's getting. Now, I will say, and correct me if I'm wrong, I noticed, and Bryce and I talked about this off camera. I texted him and I said, here's what I'm getting overnight. And the reason that you probably see a lot of these, my bottle's almost gone, and all these bottles, is because I really had to do a lot of research just on my own. And I do that. I've only done it one other time with another Blanco. That's another craft tequila coming out recently. And I don't want to have to mention them at all, but overnight, I get from the Blanco, there's this like underlying aftertaste that I get in the Blanco. And I texted Bryce the next day and I said, Bryce, is it just me? Or are we getting something, and unless you're a geek, you're not going to understand what this is, a malolactic kind of aftertaste. And he goes, yeah, he says, I didn't mention it in my review, but I am getting it. And now that I understand that this is a proprietary yeast that's made from the plants themselves it's the same thing that El Tesoro Don Felipe does. It's proprietary from their own agaves.
Right.
That's where the yeast is coming from. And because of the type of fermentation tank, it makes total sense that you would get, and unless you don't know what you're looking for. And with this one, it's not an instant.
Right.
You're not getting it right off the bat. It's later on. It's kind of like a time released malolactic flavor that I dig. I dig it. I love it because it's like, wow, I've never had that happen, like a time release. I usually get it like right away. Sometimes you'll get I think the first initial batches of Fortaleza might have that, but it's painted a little bit because of the Taona, the flavor profile that the Taona, the stone gives it. So am I wrong or is that actually what's going on here?
Grover picked up on that, right? Also, I think in his review that he did with Tequila Matchmaker. And I'll premise this with saying, I'm not a fan of that malolactic fermentation process. You slow it down,
right?
And when you slow it down so much, it does give it that effect. This is a slow process, but it's not the extra slow that you would get, for instance, like with the Atanasio or the Cascanes.
That's the one. Yeah.
Really go down to, let's say, about a week or so of fermentation. Yeah. So this is 72 hours. So there's a lot of folks that will, and so they'll hold it until it's completely done with that fermentation, right? When you see it active, the movement going on, the feeding of the sugars and all those things, right? Most places, when it slows down, they'll just go ahead and pull it, and then they'll start the process of distillation right away. Here, they will wait till it's done. And so I think that's probably that sense that you're getting.
Right.
It's not overbearing at all.
No, but
because it's that slower version of it, you're getting, I think, going back to the old days, which is part of that process of the traditional way of fermentation, that they took their time with it, right? They were slower and more deliberate about it. And that's here. I didn't want it to go too much. They kind of, this is how we do our production here. And as I understand, but I'm not big on that cheesy, funky kind of smell, right?
But I love it. Because
I know a lot of people do.
It's a clue. It's a telltale sign, as you said, of the craft idea.
Right.
Because there were other tequilas that did the same thing for years. I mean, I can remember, the there was a lot of things going on with the first batch in Fortaleza. And mind you, again, I couldn't see it. All I could do is smell it and taste it at that time.
Right.
And I know that the stone wheel gives it a certain layer, you know, but the extra fermentation, and of course, this was not below ground. It's, these are fermentation tanks, you know, on if I'm not mistaken, these are wood, similar to what to El Tesoro.
Right.
But, you know, up until Atanasio, you know, it's rare that you find, other than if you're looking for it in mezcals. In mezcals, you'll get, you're more familiar with that. You'll get that flavor profile more often than not. But in tequila, it's rare, you know. Yeah. And so when I got that, but like I say, with Don Rico, it's almost like the next day. It's a time release. You don't get it right away. It's like somewhere between dinner and dessert. You're going, what is that? What, you know,
is that a good thing or a bad thing that the next day you're still like noticing it, right?
well, no, but see, that's just it. I wanted to make sure that it wasn't just me, because I had never experienced that before. Usually if it's malolactic, I'll get it right off the bat, or I'll get it within the first two or three sips. It'll start to present itself.
Right.
But to get it the next day, it's like, wow, that's a time release, man. That's some old school stuff going on there, you know.
I really think it's the yeast is where that really
comes from. Yeah, I do too. I totally agree.
Right.
Yeah.
And for me, it was important. You know, there's a lot of testing going on, you know, for instance, champagne yeast, other types of yeast. But our product really is agave and water. That's it. Because the yeast comes from the agave itself, right? So it's all natural to the agave plant. And so I wanted that minimalist as much as possible, so that what you taste is what we put in it, and then nothing more.
Just out of curiosity, when you finally get around to doing the Taona version, the high proof, do you know if you will be fermenting with the fibers or without the fibers?
So I'm not sure, right? Because traditionally, I guess they go with the fibers. And for me, I'm thinking I'm going to go without them. There's a certain taste you get, for instance, and I think you get this with Patron, that there's almost a bitterness to it when they put the fibers on there, and it's very slight, but it's not my flavor profile. And okay. So I'm thinking that's why not to go with it. But right now I'm open to suggestions, you know, in terms of what people like, what they don't like. I know that if you do it right, you know, lot two is not going to taste like lot one. There's going to be some differences. And so that means that I can start doing some things to improve upon the production side of it, so that we can get the best possible taste. And if enough people tell me, no, you got to do it with the fibers, then I'll certainly, you know, consider that, you know, and consider it seriously. But I'm not sure. I'm leaning against it right now. We've been debating, for instance, just with the high proof. You know, you've got some at 43%, 45, 48, and then the still strength, you know, in our case, it's 55. I think 55, while it's great, you know, and the aficionados will love it, it's going to have a limited market. And we still have to, if we're going to put the investment in that much to produce it, then we got to make sure that's something that we can sell to more than just the aficionados. And so that's why I'm thinking of bringing it down to 48. So that it's not as strong, but it's still something that the average Joe will go in there and say, I can do this. I like it. And it's going to be a difference between that and our regular Blanco. You're going to.
I think there's a happy medium to find as well that make it cocktail friendly as well.
Right.
Because it's not just the average Joe that's going to sip it, you know, like I would, you know, I'll sip a 110. You know, but I might suffer the next day because I like, you know, I taste.
Tapatio, 110 is great, isn't it? You know,
110 is awesome. Yeah. But you have to, you were, I don't know if you were reading the book or Christian was reading the Consumer Catador course. There's some exercises that I enumerate there called, I call them mouth yoga. And you can do this with water, where you naturally hold the liquid in your, you know, your mouth and your gum, between your teeth and gum. You know, you do that on purpose because you want to feel that lip and gum numbness. You look for certain signs. But it's like anything else, you know, it's like a callus on your hand. The next day, you'll feel like if you do that too much, it'll and literally burn the inside of your mouth if you're not careful. So you kind of walk that thin line of overdoing it and then being cocktail right. friendly. Like there are other ones that are high proof. I can remember Cabeza, you know, which to me was Viva Mexico, but lit, you know, right. it was the same flavor profile, but up a few notches. And I missed that tequila because it was great for sipping, but it was awesome in cocktails. Cause obviously that's what it was produced to do. So I think in your case, that's probably what you'd want to do too, is right. get it to where the, like you said, the average Joe can survive the mouth yoga and still, you know, want it in a cocktail as well. And it would shine, you know.
I'm a sipper. I like my tequila neat, but I also recognize that the public wants to be able to have a better margarita or have a better paloma. Or in our case, we're working on, you know, a nice vampiro, right? So you have to have a product that is great for sipping and it's great in a cocktail, which is why we have so much fun with our videos. In fact, we're getting ready to film another one right now for the Super Bowl. So,
oh, good. Yeah, whatever you do, don't let Tiana anywhere near the ice. that was so funny. I told that gave the phrase gag reel a whole new level. You know.
Well, Christian had the sense to put that at the front to keep people's attention to see what else is coming. So
it's awesome. I think I could talk film with him for a long time because he's just, I got to tell you, whatever you did with your kids, you're great. I mean, I've never met Tiana, but Christian has really impressed me as just being willing to listen to everything and just learn yes. as, you know, as he goes. And I think his filmmaking is pretty creative. I mean, you know, he may have opened up a whole new career. But anyway, for you, you said you were a sipper. Do you sip your Blancos or what do you like to sip? What do you know? Are you an Añejo guy? What are you?
So I started out as a Reposado guy. And with these products, our products, I've kind of converted to a Blanco. And so that's what I have in my glass here right now. So I'm sipping a Blanco right now. And but I tell you, it just depends on my mood. You know, just the other day, we were just sitting around. My daughter came over and Sharon, it's like, well, aren't you going to serve me some tequila? And I'm like, what do you want? So, of course, she picks out the most expensive bottle, which was that, you know, Herencia Histórico. And so then we decided, well, let's have also some of the Tears of Llorona and let's some of that. So that's what we had the other night. So, you know, we go the extra añejo route and go with something a little more bold and a little different. So we talked about it. And generally, though, when I'm just hanging out with buddies, it's probably going to be the Blanco or the Repo. There are a couple of bars here, one just down the street from us that they carry our product there. And I just look to see whichever one has the most in the bottle. That's the one I order.
Ah, okay. Yeah. All right. So you folks are in Texas right now. You just got into Southern California. Where do you want to see Don Rico in the next 5 years?
So I'm thinking that this year we're probably going to be in Arizona and Colorado as well before the end of the year. Possibly one, maybe two other states. It just depends. But in 5 years from now, I see us probably at least, we won't necessarily, it's not my goal to be in all 50 states, but maybe, I don't know, 30, 35 states, probably Canada, probably Spain as well. You know, I want to kind of, you know, go on to that European market. Me, my partners, we have ties to the Middle East. So we want to start bringing some to the Middle East. I you know, Asia obviously is a market that's emerging. It's not quite like, let's say, Spain or Germany in terms of what they import, but I think we'll kind of make our way over time. Hopefully, you know, like I said, hit that Middle Eastern market and then as well as the European market, as well. And then, you know, most of the US. So.
Excellent. So if somebody came to you and said, Judge, I saw your success. I want a tequila brand. What are you going to tell them?
I'm going to tell them that if their heart is in it, then absolutely, by all means, go do it. But be prepared to be patient. Be prepared to spend a lot of money. Be prepared to have things drop out from underneath you, the floor drop out at a moment's notice. You have to expect that there's going to be a lot of hurdles to overcome. And that's where the patient comes in. If you're patient and you work hard towards it and you know what your ultimate end goal is, you're going to get there. You just have to make sure that you stay focused on that.
Wow. So my last question would be, how did you wind up in law? I mean, with the experience that you had, was it just something you gravitated to, or how come you didn't go into law enforcement? You know, right. I don't know.
I guess in a sense, it is law enforcement, right?
Cattle ranching. I don't know.
So I even lived around the world. I was involved in Model United Nations in high school. And so I got to meet folks from like the Shah of Iran's son, Ali Reza Pahlavi. I got to meet the current king of the Netherlands, you know, William Alexander. He was in these programs with me, you know. So you meet folks, my dad being a diplomat, that was my original plan. And I always thought, well, being an attorney, I can run for office, and through office, I could become a congressman, with my ultimate goal being the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. And never happened, obviously, but I did go to law school, and through law school, that was part of it, was, okay, well, I'll run for office. I ran, you know, became a judge. I did that. In fact, I'm this month, I'm celebrating 19 years having done that.
Ah, congratulations.
So that's always exciting. And I still have a small legal practice that I'm winding that down with the goal right now to transition into the tequila business. I was a diamond buyer when I was in college and then right after college. And so I traveled, you know, buying diamonds and for a manufacturer, jewelry manufacturer. So I got to see, you know, business from different levels. You know, I'm glad I didn't stay in the jewelry business, because that industry is mostly dead now, right? I mean, it's just not much left to it. Yeah. But this is a business I think that I can build upon, that we can leave a legacy behind. I know my kids are love it. You know, my partners they're very much engaged in it. And it's something that we're having fun. We're enjoying it. So it's not work. You have to work at it for sure.
Yeah.
But if you truly enjoy it, then I don't mind having to jump over that extra hurdle, because you know that the result is going to be well worth it.
Do you do any tastings? Do you actually go to liquor stores and like Alamo City or any place that allows you to do tastings? Do you actually get to meet and greet the public?
Absolutely. In fact, we're doing it tomorrow. There's a new liquor store just opened up in Kyle. Alamo City does carry our product. And so we're planning on doing something with them. We've done them in Dallas. We've done them here in Austin. We're getting ready to do some in El Paso. California is different. The law is different there. But we'll do some maybe private tastings, you know, just for folks. We do private parties. For instance, the North Texas Tequila Club have been huge supporters of ours, you know. So we went and did a tasting there for just members that came. And of course, they provided, we did a nice food pairing to go with it.
And then, yeah, Christian is doing, I think at the time of this recording, Christian is going to do the LA Tequila Club. I think that he's up. He was there like last week or the week before. And they're a similar club to just for the members.
I think we're going to be the featured tequila maybe in March. I'm not sure if it's March or April. So, we'll probably fly down for that to be a part of it.
And cool.
And visit, you know, different folks there in California as well.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Well, let me know when you're in town, 'cause you know, we might be able to, I don't know, share a Blanco or something. And, I think we've got all your bases covered. I so appreciate you giving me the time to do this. I know it's kind of late on your end. You're a couple hours ahead of me. It's everything that I wanted. I told Bryce, I go, I can't wait to talk to this guy, because, you know, I've seen a couple of your other interviews and it's like, wait a minute, this guy really, he's got some media training, you know?
I think being an attorney, you're just used to speaking to people.
Right.
And so the nervousness kind of goes out the window at that point.
Because
life on the line, or their freedom, you know, it's that's important. You know, this is fun.
Yeah. Well, you know, the Blanco in the Glencairn doesn't hurt either, but Rick, thank you so much. Rick Oliva, folks, of Don Rico Tequila. If you've had it, if you're watching us on YouTube or any of our other social media, let us know what you're doing with it. You know, are you putting in a cocktail? Are you sipping it neat? What's your favorite? Right now, I got to say this dark horse, this Añejo, Look at that. Look at how pretty that looks. That's just
it's a copper tone to it that's different than anything else, right?
Well, yeah. It's the wine influence that's right. Doing that, because it just has this brassy red highlights to it. It's beautiful. It'll look great in your Glencairn. Let us know if you're subscribe if you're watching us on YouTube, hit the notification bell, give us a like, follow Don Rico on Instagram. The Christian and Tiana, the whole family is involved. And the videos are great. The cocktails are excellent, actually. And whatever you folks are doing, please sip wisely. Tomar sabiamente. Rick, thank you again so much for taking the time. I do appreciate it. Whatever you guys do, sip wisely. Have a great evening.
Thank you for having me. Ay, que rico.
Ay, que rico.